On this week's 51%, we'll meet a firearms instructor who works to enroll women in shooting classes.
Women are coming to shooting because they want to take care of and protect themselves. And there's more of a realization that that responsibility falls on them.
Then a church official talks about helping widows in Nigeria, and a woman tells a story about her grandmother's choices in partners. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%. Time to get a gun. That's what I've been thinking. I could afford one. If I did just a little less drinking, time to put something between. In Maine, you do not need a gun license to buy a gun. In Maine, there are more guns than people, plus the state touts the lowest crime rate in the country. Tatiana Whitlock is a professional firearms instructor from South Portland, Maine. Teaching safe gun handling is her number one priority, and while some may believe that the firearms world is a gendered space, Whitlock says the gun doesn't care who's shooting, it just shoots. Michael Healy reports.
When I first meet Tatiana Whitlock, she's wearing an all-black fleece zipped up past her neck. She has a buzz cut. She has perfect posture, and she looks you straight in the eye. And she is really clear on her philosophy about guns.
The way I look at a firearm is in one of three ways. It can protect the things and the values and the people you love. It can provide, meaning food and sustenance, spiritual, all of that, that is the hunt. And then it's a tool to participate. And that represents the athletic side of what a firearm can do.
That's Tatiana, and firearms are her passion. She even has a favorite gun.
A Nighthawk Custom T4, which is a 9mm 1911 handgun.
The Nighthawk Custom is an all-black handgun. It looks smooth, compact, and well-made, which is part of the appeal for Tatiana.
The artist in me looks at that and just marvels at how beautiful the object is, how precise the fits are, how the tolerances just make your head spin. It's unbelievable.
Appreciation for a well-made machine runs in her family. Tatiana grew up surrounded by engineers. She herself eventually became an engineer. Childhood was filled with memories of tinkering and experiments.
We learned how to count with muffin tins, counting how many widgets in each muffin tin to then fill a bag to then be packaged for retail. That's how we grew up. The smell of molten plastic was the smell of home. You want to talk about sensory memories from childhood. It's a pretty powerful one. The sound of machinery was musical to us. It wasn't offensive.
College? Check. Industrial design degree? Check. Two kids and two new businesses within 16 months? Check. Life got busy. I think it's easy to lose yourself in your own life, and I think for a moment that was happening to Tatiana. A hobby. There needed to be a hobby. Traveling the world? Not very practical with two newborns. Skydiving? Even less practical. But then there were guns, and that seemed doable. She found a local gun club and signed up for a class.
As with all matters of the heart, when you find home, you know it. And that was it. I was hook, line, and sinker. Joined the club that week, bought my first gun 2 weeks later, and I never looked back.
She took every class offered in Maine, and then started traveling the country looking for more. Soon, she was so skilled she began giving lessons in Maine, and she noticed a trend. While people got into firearms for different reasons, a lot of those reasons seemed to depend on gender. Men, they were mostly in it for the sport, the enjoyment of it. But women...
Women are coming to shooting because they want to take care of and protect themselves. And there's more of a realization that that responsibility falls on them.
Tatiana told me she'd prefer women take mixed enrollment classes. She wants them to see that it can be a hobby too. But she also understands that many women are looking for self-defense, and that sometimes it helps to be in a woman-only environment.
This year I'm doing mostly women's only courses. The reason for that, while I'm not a proponent of it, is if my goal is to get women through the door, I need to get them to go through the door. So this year I'm doing a lot of women's only because it'll break the ice. If I can get someone who's hesitant about going into a mixed enrollment class to show up and be introduced to this content, get the confidence, and giving them the opportunity to open their eyes and see that you can shoot just as well as anybody else. You can think and solve problems just as good as anybody else.
Honed, specific, direct. That's Tatiana. She came to our interview with a bunch of facts neatly written on a piece of paper. Her teaching style is the same, practical. She's teaching and training for the real world, for the nightmare worst-case scenario, anytime you need to use a gun. For example, when you consider worst-case scenarios, like a home invasion, she says the typical practice situation, shooting at a flat piece of paper from 21 feet away, it just isn't practical.
21 feet, 7 yards, a very common training number. That's a numerical statistic based on 2 car lengths from their cruiser to the top of the other vehicle they've pulled over is typically 21 feet, 7 yards. Is the training environment contextually based to match my life?
Like, what if you have to use a gun in your home?
What's the distance from your nightstand where you keep that firearm when your kids aren't home, ready to go, and your bedroom door? You might be amazed that it's only 3 yards. Wow. You know, or less. You have to train for the fight of your life so that you can save your life.
Thinking about defending yourself with a gun in your bedroom, it's intense. There's no way around it. And for some people, taking a class focused on that can be stressful, especially for new students.
You can get so wrapped up in the object that is the firearm that you forget the reason why you're doing it.
So Tatiana also offers to meet with each student before they begin lessons. It's usually at a coffee shop, a casual place to ask any questions they want. There are no guns, no ammunition. There's probably some jazz playing in the background.
It almost always comes down to the fact that they are overwhelmed with what they know they don't know. And that fear of feeling completely overwhelmed and incompetent with this thing that could hurt you or hurt someone else, and the responsibility is enormous.
Which makes sense. It is a big responsibility to own a gun, especially if the person who's worried has kids.
Now you can multiply those by 10 to 100 times, because that just seems to be what really sets people over the edge.
Once she met a student who was particularly stressed out, they decided to meet at a Panera Bread just to chat.
She had to take some anxiety medication before she arrived, and she was shaking. She was terrified. And we were just talking about this. That's it. We weren't at the range. There was no loaded magazine being fed into a gun in a round chamber. We were just talking, saying the words.
And Tatiana can understand that kind of anxiety. She's a mom. She has her own kids. But she says the key is to store them safely and to have a plan for how to integrate firearms and home life.
The goal with kids and guns is that they are no more intrigued or interested in the object that is the firearm than they are about the blender or the toaster or the bandsaw in the basement or the cutlery in the kitchen or the poisonous chemicals that live under your sink.
It's clear that a lot of women get into firearms for different reasons than men do. It made me wonder if there's sexism within the community of people who own guns. But Tatiana made it clear she doesn't feel any gender bias, that there's no space for it. As she told me, the gun doesn't care if it's pink or black. It just shoots. Still, I wondered if there was a sense of empowerment for women who learn how to use a gun. So I asked Tatiana, does she feel like she's empowering female students when she teaches them how to shoot?
Well, let me ask you this. Do you think I am empowering my male students when I teach them how to shoot? Is that a sales pitch that she would give to a guy? Come take a lesson with Tatiana because she's going to empower you. I wouldn't make that sales pitch to a guy. Why am I making it to a woman? It implies that she's already defenseless. It implies that she's already less than. She's already diminished. And I don't care for that. It's a way for you to reconnect with your own strength. It's a way for you to make the connections with facets of yourself that are already there that perhaps you didn't know about. So in many ways, it's just reintroducing women to the fact that they are strong. And that they can be, and that here is a vehicle to bring you there.
For Salt Radio, I'm Michael Healy.
We We now leave the U.S. for a story connected with many displaced Nigerian families who are facing severe food shortages after returning home. In recent fighting, the army retook their territories from militant Islamist group Boko Haram. Many women are dealing with traumatic experiences. Their husbands were killed while many of them were forced to watch the beheadings. Their sons were forced into battles and their daughters sexually abused. Miles away in the western city of Mainz in Germany, 8 church officials founded an association called Widows Care in recognition of the needs of these women. Reverend Renate Mainzer-Elmenreich spoke with DW reporter Eunice Wanjiro to tell how Widows Care is making a difference.
Renate Elmenreich is a member of the Protestant church in the city of Mainz. Together with 7 other reverends, she formed an organization called Widows Care with the aim of raising money to support victims of the Boko Haram terror in northern Nigeria. These are mainly women and children whose husbands and fathers were killed by the terrorists. I went to see Elmenreich and wanted to know why she decided to form the organization.
Immer wieder hat mich meine ehemalige Mitarbeiterin Rebecca angerufen.
My co-worker Rebecca kept on calling me from Nigeria. She complained about the attacks and how bad it was. One day she called me and asked whether I could hear the bombing and the shooting. I could hear it in the background. It sounded really bad, just like war.
Furchtbar, wirklich wie Krieg, ne?
Having worked as a missionary in northern Nigeria from 1999 to 2004, Elmenreich knows what it means to be a widow in Nigeria, as her own husband died there after contracting a virus. Back in Germany, she was at first not sure how to help the women. Those who had fled to Maiduguri then affiliated themselves with the NGO Lifeline Compassionate Global Initiatives, which is based in Jos, and formed a branch in Maiduguri where they opened a bank account. This made it easier for Elmenreich to send money to the widows.
Und jetzt gibt es eine kleine Möglichkeit, etwas zu tun.
And now there's a small opportunity to do something. It's just a mini project amidst all the chaos in the world, but it is effective and has a clear target group. The feeling that I can do something was very important to me, because I know these women who are now widows. I knew their husbands.
Die da jetzt Witwen geworden sind, hab ihre Männer gekannt.
Elmenreich's organization Widows Care got its first donations from collections made at church services held by herself and the other reverends. They started writing about the project and different church magazines publicized the information, which triggered more donations. Elmenreich told me that donors are assured that their donations go straight to the widows. An accountant in Maiduguri provides a monthly account of how the money sent has been used.
All the money goes straight to Nigeria as soon as it comes in. The astonishing thing is that the banks are still operating, also in Maiduguri. Up to now, they have received all the money very quickly, and it was then handed over to the committee members in charge.
Elmenreich regularly gives talks on Nigeria, at which she speaks about her time as a missionary there and the impact of the terror attacks of Boko Haram a few years later. Pictures of the widows receiving help from the organization are also displayed. With the help the widows in northern Nigeria receive from Germany, they are able to start up businesses that sustain them and are now even putting money into educating the many orphans who cannot afford to go to school.
That report was by DW correspondent Eunice Wanjiro. June is LGBT Pride Month, and Emma Miller has a story to share. Calling her grandmother Gloria sassy and sagacious, Miller tells about her grandmother's having been in both a heterosexual marriage and a long-time same-sex relationship.
I tell my friends I have a lesbian grandmother. I know it's not that simple, of course. Grandma Gloria was married to my grandpa Jack for more than 2 decades. She had 3 kids during that time, including my mom. But after she got divorced, Grandma moved to New York City and spent 23 years living with a woman named Rose. Rose died in 1995. I don't really remember Rose, but I know my grandma loved her very much. I never knew the story of how Grandma and Rose came to be together. I guess I imagined something like the queer version of Eat, Pray, Love. Recently divorced woman leaves home and finds love in unexpected places. I guess I thought Grandma would tell me that she never truly loved until she met Rose. In February, after my mom had just had surgery, Grandma and I sat down together and she told me about her life. The story I got was not the one I expected. This story begins in a high school gym.
I walked in and I saw this teacher, this woman standing up on the block of wood that she stood up on, and I stood there for a moment, and it was instant love. And I knew instantly that I wanted to be with her every moment I possibly could. I was 14, and I never stopped loving her to the moment she died.
That woman was Rose. My grandmother was a star athlete, and Rose was head of all the teams. Grandma says she and Rose grew to be friends, never in a way that was inappropriate, but it was a friendship that grew to be so important to Grandma that she decided to take an extra year to graduate. She simply couldn't bear to leave Rose behind. After basketball games, Rose would take Grandma out for ice cream, and Rose's partner would come along. Gloria understood who Rose was, and Rose understood who Gloria was. I hear this, and I have to wonder, if Grandma felt all this when she was just a teenager, if she knew even then that she wanted to be with a woman, and this woman in particular, how did my grandfather come into the picture?
I went out, I went out with these guys, you know, and petted around. In those days, we called it petting and all that stuff. And, you know, and underneath it, you know, I had the sense of that there was this other part of me. And I always sensed this out of the ordinary connection and attraction. You know, I knew that was in me, but it never came to be something that I felt, obviously, that I had to express in any way. You know, I was perfectly happy with so many of these people, these young guys that I had met, including politically. This friend of mine that had been in my life, he said he had a friend coming in from Cleveland and he thought we should meet. And I said, no, no, no. And he said, yes, yes, yes. And so he set up this blind date. This man, whose name was Jack Weiner, picked me up. And we had this evening together with a lot of our old political friends that we had in common. They went drinking and listening to jazz. And when he brought me home and kissed me goodnight, I said, Gloria, you're going to marry this man. My aunt, who was staying with us that night, said to me the next day, you know, you're going to marry him. And I said, yes, I know. Well, I had fallen deeply and in love. The minute I met this man, I just had that same attraction I had to Rose. And that's who I am. I see someone or I'm involved with someone. And I just know immediately that's the person I want to be with.
To me, this sounds like something out of a movie. That whole love at first sight thing. Is that for real? I've dated guys for months and still not really known if I liked them. I wonder what this is. Is it generational? Or is it just something about Grandma?
My sense is loving someone in such a way that it completely satisfies me as a woman, as a human being. That person in my life at that time, that person I'm with in every respect.
But loving Jack wasn't always easy. My grandparents' marriage was far from perfect, and this is a story that I know well. My grandpa was a serious alcoholic. For years, he drank and he drank. He cheated on my grandma and didn't come home at night. He'd vow to get sober and then start drinking again. My grandmother stood by him through it all. Finally, my grandpa Jack cleaned up with the help of AA. He wrote a loosely fictional book about his alcoholism called The Morning After. The book received critical acclaim and it turned into a TV movie starring Dick Van Dyke. Gloria and Jack seemed to have reached a turning point.
He started every month to buy me a present to make up for all the years that he said was so hurtful and so bad. And he made all these plans. We're going to buy this house in Malibu. We're going to do this. And one day in June, Jack was writing. Started to write his second book, and he was going over, as he said, to one of the AA clubhouses to write. And he went out, and he never came back. And that was the end of the marriage. And I kept calling all over, even his sponsor, finally. And his sponsor said, he has left you. That's how I found out.
Here's the part where Rose comes back into play in Grandma's life. The two had been in touch for years, as friends. But Rose had just gotten out of a long-term relationship with another woman. Grandma called her and told her what had happened with Jack. The two reconnected. Grandma said to Rose, you know how I've always felt about you.
I said to Rose, I would just love it just if we could just explore to see what we have here. Is there something here? And she said, no, no, no. She said, I have been vulnerable all these years, and I refuse to be vulnerable again at this part of my life. And I said, all right, then there's nothing more to say. And about maybe 9 o'clock, 9:30, something like that, the phone rang. And it was Rose. And she said, you know what? I think maybe I should try to be vulnerable. She said, would you like to come to New York for New Year's Eve? And I said, yes. And I said, you know what? I'm telling you this secret. She said, I'm going to tell my kids I'm going to Paris for the week. Emma, to this day, we talk about it once in a while, and they still think I went to Paris. I still say it. So I'm walking up, you know, into her house and, you know, going in, you know, the same house that you know so well. And she was there at the door, opened the door, and came in. You know, we hugged and kissed. And she said, stretch out on the couch. This gorgeous black couch. I love that couch at that point. And I stretched out. And she said, you want anything? You want some coffee? You want some? I said, no, I'm just going to rest for a few minutes. And she said, I'll be right back. And she went into the bedroom. And she brought this out, this ring, which is a rose that she had made for herself years before. And she put it on my finger. And she said, let's really try and see what we have here. And that was, we set off June 29th. And we had this glorious 20 years together till she died, which was 2 hours before her birthday in 1995. And she gave me life.
So what's the takeaway here? Was Rose the love of Grandma's life? When I ask Grandma this, she says it's not that simple.
You know, I love Jack a lot. In some ways, I still love him. Do you? You know, I called him. Did you know that?
I didn't know that. When did you call
Right after him? I called you.
After my mom had the surgery? What was that?
I called him. He answered the phone. And I said, it's Gloria. And I said, I just wanted to talk to you for a minute. And thank goodness Amy's okay. I told him I'd spoken to you. And I talked how lucky we are to have a great-grandson and everything. And I said, you know, Jack, I said, these are our children. You know, and I said, you know, we share these children. I said, these are our children. We're so blessed to have these amazing three children. And look at our grandchildren. And we went through the whole thing. And I said, no one can take that away from us. You know, this is what we did.
And she says this, and I have this momentary flash where time fasts forward, and I see myself talking to my own grandkids, and I see how my own choices and relationships and first dates and kisses could get me to this point where I'm sitting here and talking to someone two generations removed from myself, only I'm telling them about my life, and this person knows they exist because of me and because of love, and I am fulfilled. I realized then that this isn't a story about my grandmother's sexuality. It's a story about a woman who has opened herself up to others, who has felt deeply, who has lived without regret.
There is nothing in your grandma's life, not one thing she wants, is not one thing she needs. She's had the most important gift of all, being loved.
That's our show for this week. Thanks to Katie Britton for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1352.